Call from mom. Answer it. Call silenced.
Instacart knows nothing gets between you and the game. That's why they make ordering from your couch easy. Stock up today and get all your groceries for the week delivered in as fast as 30 minutes without missing a minute of the game.
You have 47 new voicemails.
Download the app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
T-Mobile has invested billions to light up America's largest 5G network, from big cities to small towns, including right here in yours. And great coverage is just the beginning. Right now, families and small businesses can save up to 20% versus AT&T and Verizon when they switch. Visit your local T-Mobile store today.
Plan savings with three lines of T-Mobile Essentials versus comparable available plans. Plan features and taxes and fees may vary.
Stating news during the pandemic, here you can listen to one of the bright spots.
104-year-old Vivian Myers got COVID-19.
I've accepted it, but I don't like it.
And she just got out of the rehab unit at a Maryland nursing home after beating the virus. Caregivers applauded and saluted her.
We walked her back to her old room. Just felt so good. I really did. I think everybody was crying.
Nurse Tara West calls Miss Vivian a success story who will continue to keep them on their toes. Steve Kathan, CBS News.
104. How about that, Tommy?
That's a great story. I also saw one a couple of weeks ago about a woman that, true story, over 100, that survived the 1918 pandemic and survived this one.
How about that? A double pandemic survivor.
Yeah. And I'm thinking, you know, if she'd change her lifestyle, she might not be getting sick all the time.
All the time.
Thank you, Dave.
You're welcome.
Greg Gray joins us now, infectious disease epidemiologist and professor at Duke University. He leads the Duke One Health Network, which involves more than 30 professionals studying more than 30 pathogens under 30 research and training projects running in 14 countries. I don't think the news you're going to have for us is very comforting, doctor, but I appreciate your time.
Well, thank you very much for inviting me on.
But the truth is what it is. I guess let's go back and establish a foundation a little bit, maybe, with spillover infections and pathogens jumping from animals to people, from animals to different kinds of animals. How exactly does that happen? And how dangerous is it?
Well, we all carry a number of different infectious agents as part of our microbiome. Humans do, animals do. And when we come in close contact, some of those pathogens come in close contact with other species. And so there's, you could look at it as a constant onslaught of various different immune systems when two species come together. And sometimes the foreign infectious agents, microbes, take hold in the new species. They find a way in. They find a receptor. And over time, they can adapt to the new host and then sometimes become highly transmissible and cause disease. And so this is a normal phenomenon that, you know, we have seen evidence of for many years. But in recent years, we've noted it more frequently, partially due to our ability to detect these jumps, these spillover events with new molecular diagnostics.
So I'm looking here, 21st century has already experienced SARS, horseshoe bats via civet cats, H1N1 flu, pig flu, I guess, or swine flu, MERS, and that's bats via camel, and COVID-19, bats via an intermediate. Is this airborne transmission, or do you always know? Does some animal, and I'm not trying to sound stupid here, but does an animal have to bite somebody? Do they have to come into contact with this person, touch a similar surface, or all of the above?
Well, we think that each pathogen has probably a number of ways it can move from host to host. Some of those ways include direct contact. you know, through sharing of oral secretions, fecal matter, whatever, or some of it through inanimate objects. Coming in contact with, for instance, the oral secretions of an animal that has salivated on something you touch. And there's also evidence of aerosol transmission in some of the pathogens, that is movement either in large droplets, which usually fall to the ground relatively rapidly, or small droplets, we call it aerosol droplets, from host to host. So as human populations grow in numbers and become more dense, like in our metropolitan areas, and animal populations grow in numbers, such as in the industrialized farming to feed those populations, we have the frequent intermingling, if you will, of species sometimes. Another way, of course, is through increases in wild animal trafficking, humans coming in contact with wild animals, sometimes for food, such as in live animal markets that we've seen in Asia, the movement of these animals in aircraft, pets or various transport through zoos or whatever. So in recent years, because of advances in transportation and food production, we are seeing, I think, more and more increasing number of these crossover events. But it's hard to tease out if those increases are due to the growing populations and increasing contact or due to the better diagnostics and detecting them.
Or both, I guess, right?
It's probably a combination of both.
Yeah. So let me go back to the 21st century and the four major spillovers. SARS, swine flu, I guess, H1N1, COVID-19, and MERS. Are there vaccines? I know there's no COVID-19 vaccine, but have we discovered a vaccine for SARS or H1N1 or MERS?
Well, let's start with SARS. There were a number of vaccine constructs that went pretty far in development. There were some mixed results on those, and we're actually benefiting from those in attempting to develop vaccines against SARS-CoV-2, the cause of COVID-19. In a similar fashion, there have been vaccine constructs for MERS, but the target, instead of going to humans, at least one of the targets has been to vaccinate the intermediate host, that being camels, much the same as we reduce human risk of rabies by vaccinating cats and dogs. The idea is if we could vaccinate camels against the virus, we could reduce human infections with MERS. The 2009 pandemic, we've had a good vaccine against that for a number of years, and it's become a component of our seasonal vaccine. Depending on the viruses that are circulating, those seasonal vaccines work really well or they don't work perfectly. At any rate, we're always attempting to anticipate the next influenza A threats, influenza B threats, by designing a cocktail to anticipate some 6-8 months in advance. And that cocktail can differ for the Northern Hemisphere versus the Southern Hemisphere. So anyway, we do have vaccines that are pretty darn good against influenza. We'd like sort of a master vaccine that would prevent all influenza A vaccine or infections. And we're just not there yet.
Let me pick it up here. We come back. We're talking to Dr. Craig Gray, nice enough to give us some of his time, an infectious disease epidemiologist and professor at Duke University. He leads the Duke One Health Network, which involves more than 30 professionals studying more than 30 pathogens under 30 research and training projects running in 14 countries. And we'll get the doctor's opinion when we come back. In terms of something like COVID, it's not a question of will it happen? It's a question of when it happens, how often it's going to happen again, and how bad could it get? And that goes to research. Do we have enough funding for those kind of research to I guess, deal with or prevent zoonotic spillovers to begin with. And I also want to go a little bit to this origin of the COVID-19 with the lab in Wuhan or the wet market. I think we might get caught tapping on the seatbelt light there while the plane is crashing, because I don't think that really matters as much as dealing with what we have now and preventing what could happen in the future. 9:17, Tommy Tucker back in a flash here on WWL. 9:22, Dr. Greg Gray, nice enough to give us some of his time. He's an infectious disease epidemiologist and professor at Duke University. He leads a Duke One Health Network and involves more than 30 professionals studying more than 30 pathogens under 30 research and training projects running in 14 countries. Doctor, as it relates to the question of not if this will ever happen again, is it a question more of when and how often?
Well, I certainly think so. We historically have seen a number of respiratory virus large epidemics in the last 50 years. You mentioned four of them, but there were others, including those caused by a number of different strains of adenovirus and enteroviruses, hand, foot, and mouth disease, and the killer cold virus. So I think these are going to continue, and the trick is, can we find ways to identify them early on, particularly those that are moving animals to man? And I think the way forward is basically to do targeted surveillance at populations of people who work closely with animals. So here at Duke and with our partners international, we've designed some One Health-oriented surveillance studies where periodically we would sample people, their animals, and their work environments for novel viruses. And then depending on what we find, for instance, we'll likely first find it in the animals, and then we'd find evidence of it in the people, we could develop diagnostics and vaccine constructs years ahead of before those viruses became highly transmissible to man. So the idea is to shift detection years before the next pandemic pathogen emerges to spread across large populations of people. And you know, that's what we'd like to do. It's a little hard to focus on that right now because everybody is responding to the current pandemic. But I think we're seeing the U.S. government begin to think about that, as well as we'll likely see other government research programs try to anticipate the next threats.
In terms of funding, has it been a And Hurricane Camille hit the Gulf Coast in the 60s, and it seems like immediately after that, in that area, they started building 20 feet off the ground. And then for just about every year after that, they came down a foot because memories fade, right? And then before you know it, they're building houses just at street level again. And the reason I mention that is it's on everybody's mind now, right? Everybody is just determined, bound and determined to not only find a vaccine for COVID-19, but to make sure this doesn't happen again. However, after we recover and get back to normal, do you think the funding, the support for your efforts will be there?
Well, Tommy, I think your suggestions are right on the mark. We have a tendency to legislate government response for the tyranny of the moment, you know, the threat of the moment, and then that support has a tendency to wane. And you just can't do that when you don't exactly know what the next threat's going to be. Mm-hmm. And so we do need some sort of focused, progressive program in collaboration with countries, often in the developing world, where a lot of these pathogens seem to emerge, to anticipate these threats. And I'll tell you, it's tough right now to even get funding to think about that, because everybody is very intensely testing available off-the-shelf medicines, trying to develop new interventions and vaccines, and trying to improve the treatment to keep people alive in this pandemic.
One thing that surprised me, well, first of all, getting back to what I was saying before the break, In terms of postmortem and in terms of understanding how something happened, I get that. But as far as politics, are we getting kind of distracted if we start arguing about whether it was the wet market, whether it was in a lab in China that was carelessly handled? I have seen numerous reports that said there is no way this was man-made or being cultivated as a weapon. Would you like to address any of that as it relates to COVID-19?
Well, again, I think you're right on the mark. You know, the forensic aspect of virology, the people that look at the sequences, have uniformly said that this was not a laboratory-manipulated virus. At least they see no evidence of that. And the evidence that this could have been cultivated as a clandestine, you know, secret weapon also seems pretty far out there. And so what I think we're seeing, unfortunately, is a lot of posturing between countries for political purposes. And I do think what we need to do is get out and do the surveillance to anticipate if there are going to be variants of SARS-CoV-2 that are going to be immunologically unique and cause, for instance, a second wave infections, even infecting those that have been infected with SARS-CoV-2 originally. If there are novel viruses emerging, progeny viruses from this pandemic virus, are they circulating in animals we should know about? For instance, have they, in a way we call reverse zoonoses, gone back into domestic livestock and are circulating there? We don't know because we're not really looking. And would something new come out of, for instance, domestic livestock farms? So there's been an editorial about that recently among veterinarians that we better watch closely because these coronaviruses have a tendency to so easily jump species that they don't jump in the livestock and cause us new problems.
You know, when you mention that, I'm just wondering about working with veterinarians. They would have to be an integral part of this. Does it cross multi-disciplines? Who all is involved in this and some of the major players?
Well, I think veterinarians are extremely important in zoonoses and often not given the respect they merit. If you think about some of these novel emerging zoonotic pathogens, they're often the first to be infected and in some instances the first to die. And then we say, oh, we got a problem. A veterinarian or a veterinary technician is down. And we, in One Health, embrace veterinarians in a very special way. We say complex problems that are then involve animals, we just can't solve them without some sort of collaboration with veterinarians. Additionally, we also argue that we need collaborations for those from the environmental sciences, because some of these pathogens, you know, reside in water, in the soil, in the air, and so we need experts to know how to sample those media. And then finally, I have argued that we have to find ways to partner with the animal industries, the meat production people. Now we see how important that is with so many meat production facilities having difficulty keeping their personnel and production going. But the production can also serve as a generation of novel viruses or novel bacteria or pathogens that are drug resistant. So we have to find ways to work with the industry, with veterinarians, and with environmental health sciences to approach some of these complex problems like emerging infectious diseases that are zoonotic, like antimicrobial resistance, various different problems with our food safety and food security.
One thing that astounded me, when you think of wet markets, you think of, you know, something in the middle of a tropical country somewhere where it, you got to travel through 15 miles of brush to get to it. But we actually have these things in New York. Is that right?
Yeah, we have, you know, we're a multicultural nation. And, you know, telling folks that for thousands of years have celebrated, you know, eating a diversity of animals to stop their cultural norms, it's sort of like telling us not to have Thanksgiving. I mean, it's a big ask. And so while we're seeing changes, and for instance, in China, in the large metropolitan areas, they've outlawed some of these and gone to packaged meat. That transition is going to take a number of generations. And so rather than demanding that everything, you know, happen overnight in all areas of the world, which I don't think is too realistic, what we've got to do is find ways to educate people and gradually get their cooperation, conduct surveillance, improve the situation in a mutually beneficial way. And I think we can do that in One Health, you know, with partnerships. Instead of trying, if you attempt to close this, the tendency would be for the sales of sort of exotic animals to go underground. And that could make things even worse. You cannot trace the source. You wouldn't know where the viruses are coming from. And you could have an even bigger disaster.
In terms of, we know how hard New York was hit by COVID-19. If one of these spillover infections had happened there, originated at a wet market in New York, what would it have, or what could it have possibly looked like in New York as opposed to what happened with COVID?
Well, you know, I think evidence now suggests that COVID was in New York earlier than we thought, and mm-hmm. it exploded and was sort of under the radar for some time until the testing caught up with it. I mean, it would be a similar phenomenon, assuming you had the same transmissibility of the pathogen and the close contact of the food workers, if you will, in their communities. So I don't know that it would be too different if it was the same, a similar virus. But the idea is that, you know, those markets, and it's not just New York, we have them in many other areas of the country, in some areas that are not so densely populated. Those markets could be an itis of transmission from animals to humans. But so could, you know, any other venue, you know, state fairs, county fairs, meat processing plants, wholesale meat markets. So there are many different places where we come in close contact with animals, and we need to be thinking about how to keep the workers safe and how to do surveillance for novel viruses that might emerge from those animals and come in contact with those exposed to those animals.
If I may ask you a personal question before we let you go, how do you sleep at night knowing what's out there or what potentially could be out there?
Well, I have confidence in modern medicine and what we're doing. I mean, here at Duke, we absolutely go over the top to protect people that come into, for instance, our hospitals, to protect the workers. And yet we're attempting to intervene. We're studying these pathogens. So there's a balance of some personal and institutional risk and yet attempting to advance science. But it's not too much different, I think, than other occupations that put people in harm's way. You know, and one could argue that the military is a good example, and certainly policemen and firemen. But now I guess the limelight is on hospital workers and their risk, and appropriately so, because, you know, they are doing some wonderful things at great personal risk to themselves.
Well, thank you for the work that you're doing, and you know, to saving a world might be strong, but I think you're heading in that direction. Thank you, sir. Well, I hope we get to talk to you again, Dr. Greg Gray, infectious. Sir?
Thank you, Tommy.
Oh, you're quite welcome. Dr. Greg Gray, infectious disease epidemiologist and professor at Duke University. He leads the Duke One Health Network, which involves more than 30 professionals studying more than 30 pathogens under 30 research and training projects running in 14 countries. And I like to have people like the doctor on, not just for the information that we glean, but there are so many smart people that we have never heard of, that we have no idea what they do. But for them, this world would not be like it is today. We ought to have a hug the smartest kid in a room day or something. Not the kid that's in the room now, because that would cause trouble. Let's just move on. 9:37, 23 before 10, traffic on WWL.
We really need new phones.
T-Mobile will cover the cost of four amazing new iPhone 15s, and each line is only $25 a month.
New iPhone 15s? It's better
over here. Only at T-Mobile, get four iPhone 15s on us and four lines for $25 per line per month with eligible trade-in when you switch.
Minimum of 4 lines for $25 per line per month with auto pay discount using debit or bank account. $5 more per line without auto pay, plus taxes and fees. Phone fee at 24 monthly bill credits for well qualified customers. Contact us before canceling account to continue bill credits or credit stop and balance on required finance agreement due. $35 per line connection charge applies. See T-Mobile.com.